Good afternoon. It's Air Talk coming your way several hours later today because of two special live news events. For more than 5 hours, the House Intelligence Committee holding the first of the public hearings in its impeachment inquiry. The next public session will be this Friday. We'll have live coverage for you beginning early in the morning right here on KPECC. And then we just heard the news conference at the White House between President Trump and President Erdogan of Turkey. We also heard President Trump responding to a question about a new piece of information that emerged from this morning's impeachment inquiry hearing. That about a phone conversation that was detailed by William Taylor, the highest-ranking U.S. official in Ukraine. Taylor said in the meeting that he was informed of something by a staff member. I think we have that clip for you.
Last Friday, a member of my staff told me of events that occurred on July 26th. While Ambassador Volker and I visited the front, this member of my staff accompanied Ambassador Sondland. Ambassador Sondland met with Mr. Yermak. Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for. At the time I gave my deposition on October 22nd, I was not aware of this information. I am including it here for completeness.
William Taylor, highest-ranking U.S. official in Ukraine. President Trump, just minutes ago, asked about this conversation, said he didn't have any recollection of it, also said this is hearsay. Joining us is NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron has been listening throughout the course of the day to the two men as they answered questions from members of the House Intelligence Committee. Ron, was that the only new piece of information we had beyond what was in the transcripts from last week's private testimony?
That was the only incident. That was the only event that had not been described previously, and it wasn't described previously because, as Ambassador Taylor said, he only learned of it last Friday. So when he gave his earlier deposition in October, he would not have had any knowledge of it. But this was an event that had been brought to his attention subsequently, and he wanted to add it to the record for the sake, as he said, of completeness. But of course, because it is a little bit new, and because it does flesh out the picture of President Trump's direct involvement and direction of this, well, whatever we want to call it, transaction that he was proposing, that it was a condition of the meeting to be held between the two presidents here in Washington in the Oval Office that President Zelensky very much wanted to have happen. It was a condition for that, and it was also a condition for the release of nearly $400 million in vitally needed military aid to hold off the Russians on their eastern frontier. And that condition was that they conduct investigations into the Bidens and also into a theory of what happened in 2016.
And Ron, sort of stripping out all the politics, which is difficult because this is all such a political process, as we heard in the framing of the questions from both sides throughout the course of the day. But what is the central issue here in the Democrats' allegation of presidential wrongdoing versus how Republicans see that specific issue of what's alleged to be worthy of impeachment?
The Republicans are saying that there was no harm done here because the aid eventually was released after months of being held up, and the investigations that the president was demanding have not been conducted. But here's the reason that that was actually released, that the aid was released, and why the investigations have not happened. And that reason is very simple, and that is that a whistleblower came forward, reported on the president's call to Zelensky and the conditionality of the investigations being the key to getting the aid. And after that whistleblower's complaint had been forwarded to Congress, and Congress had begun to respond to it and say, hey, what's going on here? And the State Department itself had already validated the whistleblower's complaint as valid and serious. At that point, not before, but 48 hours after the Congress found out about the whistleblower's report, that's when the president stopped putting a hold on the aid and stopped saying that he could set up a meeting with Zelensky once investigations had begun. And that's why the investigations haven't begun.
And so is the Republican argument here that essentially the Joe and Hunter Biden issue is sort of incidental to the president wanting to have corruption investigated in Ukraine, and that he didn't really intend to hold those dollars long term, but sort of the short term hold of them was just to send a message, but it wasn't a full quid pro quo. Is that what they're arguing?
That is what they're arguing. But in fact, the president never talked about corruption in his phone call with Zelensky, unless it's in that portion of the transcript of that phone call that we haven't seen. We know it's only a summary. We know it's not complete or verbatim, despite the White House characterizations of it. Right from the very beginning, it was described as a summary. So maybe in there somewhere, the president says, I've got a real problem with corruption anywhere in the world, and I want you, President Zelensky, to deal with it in your part of the world. He doesn't use that word. What he says is, I want you to do this investigation with respect to the 2016 business, and then he also wants some kind of investigation of the Bidens. And that's what the hurdle is that Zelensky is being asked to get over before he can have a meeting in Washington, D.C. with the president and before the aid can be allowed to flow. And by the way, that aid was approved by Republicans and Democrats, but primarily by Republicans, especially in the Senate. And when it was finally released in September after the whistleblower's complaint had been made, it was Republicans in the Senate who announced that it was finally flowing, not the president.
Now, going back to the Obama presidency, wasn't there aid that was an issue to under Ukraine's old corrupt leadership that Joe Biden was holding back in an effort to get rid of the prosecutor who was universally condemned for lack of following through on corruption investigations? So in that case, wasn't that congressionally approved funding that was also through the presidential administration withheld?
The difference there is that you're talking about a different administration and a different set of disputes. And what was being sought was not for the personal benefit of Barack Obama. It was not to help him get reelected. He had already gotten reelected. And there was no issue of whether or not Barack Obama was going to be on the ballot in 2016. We do have an issue of Donald Trump being on the ballot in 2020. And we do have him asking not for a favor for United States policy, as Joe Biden had been doing, not for something that was consonant with what the broader U.S. policy in Ukraine was. No, he's asking instead for something that doesn't really have anything to do with the American relationship with the Ukrainians. It's just an investigation of the Bidens for the sake of Donald Trump's reelection campaign. That's the difference.
We're talking with Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. We're talking about today's 5 hours plus of testimony by two State Department employees, one the highest ranking U.S. official to the Ukraine, the other a longtime State Department official, both of them testifying openly as they had testified behind closed doors before the House Intelligence Committee last week. Ron, is the Republican argument about the 2016 election issue with Ukraine that they believe that Ukraine, that the efforts to affect the U.S. election and to support Hillary Clinton and to harm President Trump politically, that initiated within Ukraine? And is their argument in President Trump bringing that up in the phone call that is in the U.S. interest, not purely to his political benefit?
It's not clear how it could be in the benefit of the United States unless you feel that the intent there was to reopen the investigation of who interfered in our election in 2016 and contradict the conclusion of every U.S. security and intelligence agency, which has been that that was the Russians and that they did it to help Donald Trump get elected. Now, of course, that's not a narrative the president likes. It's not. It's one that he has consistently rejected. And he has seized upon a theory put forward, essentially a conspiracy theory put together by Rudy Giuliani and some other people, that it was Ukraine all along and that Ukraine was framing the Russians and fooling the American CIA into thinking it was the Russians who were interfering in our election and that they had done this because obviously the Ukrainians have a beef with Russia. That theory has been debunked from all directions and from top to bottom, but Rudy Giuliani was, eating out on it for some period of time, got some journalists to pay attention to it for at least a while, and also he and some of his associates were using it to pressure people overseas to try to cooperate more with the Trump administration and its effort to, in some sense or another, turn around that whole 2016 story, the whole narrative we've been reading about from Robert Mueller's report and everywhere else for the last several years.
Ron, I want to move to the political side of this in the Senate, because there have been some questions that if the House votes to impeach the president, that the Senate, because I think it only needs 51 votes to do this, could refuse to hold a trial and could just say they're not going to act on the House impeachment if it impeaches. But I saw that today it's looking very unlikely Republicans would have that threshold. What do you know about that?
Well, we know that they have the votes if they decided to just enforce party discipline and say, if you're a Republican, you're voting not to have a trial. They would have the votes to do it. They have 53 votes. But Mitch McConnell, their leader, who has been pretty good at predicting what they were going to do, and of course he is in the key position to know and decide what they're going to do, he has said consistently they need to have a trial, that if the House should impeach, then the Senate would have a hard time refusing to have a trial. The Constitution seems to indicate that it should, and it all sets up this Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, as the person to preside over that trial. And it anticipates that any impeachment would result in a trial. There was an attempt to head it off back in Bill Clinton's time, but the Senate went ahead and voted to hear the evidence. And there was even one Democratic vote for hearing the evidence in that case, but it was mostly the rest of them were Republicans, and so they went forward. Again, this time, I think it would be unlikely the Republicans would want to just completely ignore a legitimate impeachment process from the House. They could. It seems unlikely that they would contradict what Mitch McConnell has said up to now, but we can't rule it out. If they're just so dissatisfied with what the process has been in the House, they could stonewall it.
Ron, as always, thank you so much. I know it's an incredibly busy day for you, as many will be in the coming weeks. Thank you for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
Thank you so much. Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent with us on Air Talk. We have a full hour left to come. We'll be talking with Republican analyst Sean Walsh. We'll be talking with John Iadarola, host of the Daily Politics show, The Damage Report. And we have other guests who are going to be with us as well. You're listening to Air Talk on Later Than Is Typical, live here on 89.3 KPCC. Good afternoon. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. No, you're not confused about time of day. We're just delayed coming on because of NPR's live coverage, both of the House impeachment inquiry, first public session today, and then President Trump with President Erdogan of Turkey with their joint news conference from the White House. We continue with our analysis of the first of the public impeachment hearings. With me is Republican political analyst Sean Walsh and the host of the Daily Politics show, The Damage Report, John Iadarola. Sean, let me start with you on this morning. So much of this political rhetoric and efforts to frame it. But as you look at the conduct that's alleged here, what is the argument of the conduct that Republicans are making?
Well, they've put out 10 kind of arguments, I think they're somewhat weak. But the bottom line is they're saying there was no quid pro quo, there was no crime committed. I think the Democrats actually have a tough time. We've already seen this out there. Republicans don't think there was a crime. Some Democrats do think there was a crime. There was nothing really new that was brought forward today, but for the Sutherland phone call where an aide purportedly overheard the call, and what do you overhear on that call, number one. And then number two, these individuals were not in the West Wing. They were not in the Oval Office. They were not on the National Security Council staff listening. So it was secondhand testimony. I'm not sure anything new was really brought forward today that I think helps the Democrats' case. The next person's coming up on Friday, and then maybe things not further until next week. So, you know, at some juncture, the public, without something new and riveting, may lose interest in this issue.
And so are Republicans arguing that, let's take the rough transcript of the phone call, that what President Trump is asking for there is nothing that serves his interests, or it serves his interests but doesn't rise to the level of self-dealing that would be worthy of removal from office? What is the threshold they see being crossed or not crossed?
I think that they can say that there was corruption going on. The president wanted to have that investigated, but it was not crossing the line where he actually wanted this as a benefit. A gift, I guess, from a foreign government to benefit his campaign. So the argument they're going to make is the line was not crossed insofar as getting a foreign government to actually contribute to his own campaign.
So even though he raises the issue of the Bidens and the company that Hunter Biden's board sits on, he raises that specific issue. He raises the 2016 election and allegations, Ukraine-based interference targeted him in the election. They're arguing that that doesn't provide him with a political benefit?
Yeah, that's the argument. Look, you know, everybody needs a shower after this thing. It doesn't look good, doesn't smell good, but their argument is going to be that he didn't cross the line into what was a crime, asking for, meaning you have to investigate Joe Biden and his son, or else I'm not going to give you the military aid. So that's their argument. You know, I do think it smells really bad and it looks really bad. And why a president is actually engaged in something like this, as opposed to having, you know, his members from the State Department or any other entity go and do that, I don't know. But that's what this president does. So the question is, you know, at the ultimate, let's read fast forward. Unless somebody comes in like, in my view, John Bolton, who was his national security advisor, who is very unhappy with the president and his activities with Turkey, comes in and drops in, I think, a bomb, a smoking gun. I don't see right now anything that's moving this forward and getting other Republicans in the Senate to get off of their position now, which would be to acquit.
Okay. And so the Republican argument would be there's not a smoking gun because he released the money, and that's one of the arguments. But as Ron Elving of NPR just said, that was after the word of the whistleblower's complaint. So is timing not an issue there?
Well, so that's part of the Democrats' argument, but then the Republicans' argument coming back today was, well, wait a minute. You're saying that politics was played here. The Senate and the Congress passed military aid to support the Ukrainians against the Russians, and the Obama administration held that aid up, held it up for a long time. Why was that aid held up? So those are, you know, it's the politics of this, Larry. And so the Republicans are going to play a certain role to try and cast doubt into this, and the Democrats are going to say, no, clearly he was trying to extort.
Yeah.
The government. So.
I know it is a political process, Sean, but I guess I'm trying as much as possible to try and strip it back to, you know, what actually happened as far as we know, and kind of what is the threshold that's being debated here. Let me bring the Damage Reports host, John Iadarola, in. John, thank you for joining us. What did you think was the most substantive part of what you heard today?
Well, I would say that of all that we've learned in the past few months, what we learned today was not particularly important. I do think that the Bill Taylor revelation of the phone call is interesting. I don't think that it rises to the level of, of importance of some of what we've learned since this scandal initially arose. Mostly it was a reiteration of his concerns that we knew about from the text messages with that slight bit of extra information. I think that the overall case that has been made looks really bad, but I wouldn't say that today was particularly important in expanding my concern about it, no.
Sean has said a couple times on the program that he thinks a game changer for Republicans could potentially be John Bolton coming in and dropping some sort of a bombshell. Short of something like that, do you see an avenue for Democrats to get removal of the president in the Senate?
I don't necessarily know, but that's also not a particularly important consideration in my mind. I think that the House has a constitutional obligation to pursue impeachment, considering what we've already learned, and then it's on the Senate to do their job. And if it turns out that we have such an insanely partisan composition to our Senate right now and such a devoted cult of personalities of the president, not only amongst his base, but also amongst the elected representatives, then that's a separate concern that we'll have to deal with when that comes up. But right now, the House is doing what it's constitutionally obligated to do, and that is to have these hearings, to lay out the evidence, and I think that that's what's important right now.
We're talking with John Iadarola. He hosts the Daily Politics show, The Damage Report. Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst with us as well. John, what were your thoughts about how the hearings were conducted today? We had a number of points where Republicans raised they want the whistleblower to testify, and they want to be able to call additional witnesses that apparently are not going to be part of this. Were there any surprises for you at all in the process of the day?
Not necessarily. I mean, much of what was raised by Republicans during the actual hearings is consistent with what they've been saying up until the hearings began, both them, the elected representatives, but then also, people like Sean Hannity and things like that in right-wing media. They say that this entire process is a sham, and they're dedicated to making sure that that is true by trying to bring in members of the Biden family and things like that, when that has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not Donald Trump committed some sort of crime. I understand their desire to focus this on the whistleblower, because there's an element of mystery to that. We don't know who the whistleblower is. It's possible that if you believe that this entire process is illegitimate, then you can imagine that the whistleblower is some sort of insane never-Trumper or Obama plant or something like that. I've never understood the obsession with the whistleblower. The whistleblower told us their initial concerns. Those concerns have been borne out by any number of different other officials. It's irrelevant to me who the whistleblower is. But the concerns over the whistleblower are placed in this overall messaging about the concern that what we learned today was not firsthand information, except for the communications that Bill Taylor had with Sondland. And they want people with firsthand information. The issue.
But the whistleblower didn't have firsthand information, right?
Well, exactly. But the main issue with trying to make that your big argument is that the Trump administration is doing everything they can, both inside of the law and, I would argue, outside of the law, to stop anyone with firsthand information from actually testifying. And so it's a little bit self-serving to claim that we should only find out what happened from people who were there themselves, and then they are stopping those people from actually testifying.
John, thank you for being with us. Sean, thank you for being with us. I'm going to let you both go because you've been working overtime hanging on with us to get to you. Thank you both very much. I really appreciate it. John Iadarola, The Damage Report, his show. Sean Walsh, a Republican political analyst, also with us. Professor Emeritus at Syracuse University School of Law, William C. Banks. Professor Banks is co-author of Constitutional Law, Structure and Rights in Our Federal System, published last year. Professor, good to have you with us. Your thoughts about this, from a legal perspective, how the day proceeded?
I think you've done a really good job of laying out the essentials, Larry, and it's, as you say, at its heart, it's a political process in the hands of the House now and the Senate later, but there is law involved, and it's important, I think, for your listeners to separate what the politics of impeachment amount to and what the law is. It's not necessary for impeachment to consist of criminal conduct. It's not important that there be a bribe.
I'm so sorry. We've got a problem with your phone, Professor Banks. We're going to try and get that squared away, and we'll take a very brief break. You're listening to Air Talk on a delayed basis today. We're still live coming your way in this 2 o'clock hour after this morning's testimony, day one of the public portion of the House impeachment inquiry before the House Intelligence Committee, chaired by Southern California's own Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of the greater L.A. area. The next day of open hearings will be on Friday. We'll also have it for you live beginning early in the morning right here on 89.3 KPCC. We'll do our best to get Professor Banks' line cleared up and talk with him in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to take you up to Marketplace at 3 o'clock this afternoon as we bring you a delayed program today because of special NPR coverage of two major events, the hearings, the impeachment hearings for the House Intelligence Committee and the news conference President Trump and Turkish President Erdogan from the White House. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get things cleared up on the phone line of Professor Banks, so we'll have to get him on perhaps Friday after our next day of coverage of the open sessions. Some significant news here in Southern California, where SoCal Edison has agreed to reimburse state agencies, fire, and police a total of $360 million for costs incurred as a result of the Woolsey and Thomas fires. Joining us a little bit later in the hour will be KPCC correspondent Sharon McNary, who will be talking with us about that. But joining me right now is the owner of Einhorn Insurance in San Diego, our guest Eric Einhorn. He specializes in policies for those that live in fire-prone areas. We've been getting word that homeowners in those communities in the wake of these rash of wildfires have been canceled and then had to pay much more if they could get policies or even turn to the mandatory California FAIR plan if a typical insurer would not cover them. Mr. Einhorn, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
No, no problem. I appreciate you having me.
So how many clients have you been hearing from that they've been canceled or having a hard time getting policies?
Let me get my calculator out. it's a very, very challenging time in the insurance world. And it started at the beginning of the year, after the fires in the fourth quarter of last year. The insurance companies have really tightened their underwriting guidelines, which has resulted in many, many companies trying to reduce their risk and their exposure. So I receive probably 2 to 3 non-renewals a week, and it's rampant all over California. And it's not specifically one company. It's a variety of insurance companies that are just realizing that they've got way too much exposure on the books.
So how are they deciding this? If you've got a customer who's never filed a claim, their home hasn't suffered any fire or smoke damage, but they've been canceled, is that something that you can assume is happening to everybody covered by that same company within that same area?
I couldn't answer that because I don't have the insides of the insurance company's books. But the way I view it and what I've seen is that insurance companies are looking at how their risk is spread out over different areas. And if they've got a lot of homes insured in a specific area that is risky for fire damage, they will remove some of those. They may keep some, but a catastrophe could cause huge losses to an insurance company.
So it's not across the board in a given neighborhood. That's interesting. So they might just say, well, we need to have fewer homes in this area to balance the portfolio of customers we've got. Wow.
Yeah, and it's really carrier specific. So some companies are removing all homes anywhere near any type of fire hazard. If you back up to a canyon, if you live across the street from somebody who has a canyon backed up to them, you may get canceled. Others are being a little bit more picky and a little more strategic and keeping some homes on the books, and they're sending out non-renewal notices to others.
Where did they turn then? Are there typically other companies that are willing to insure, but maybe for much more money? Or are folks having to turn to what's the backup, the pool of the California FAIR Plan?
Yeah, so that is the biggest challenge right now is, you know, each individual insurance company has got their own underwriting guidelines that they follow. And there are quite a few different characteristics of each area that they look at when determining which homes they're going to insure or not. So if you're getting non-renewed by one, there's a very good chance you're going to get declined by the majority of other home insurance companies out there. So you have two different types of insurance companies. You have admitted and non-admitted. And admitted companies are the ones you always want to be insured with if you have the opportunity. They're fully regulated by the Department of Insurance in California. They're backed by the California Guarantee Fund. And the reason that that's important is because if a home insurance company gets hammered with catastrophic claims and they're unable to pay the claims, the California Guarantee Fund is basically a pool of money that's there to bail out the claimants if the insurance company goes insolvent. So you'll always go to the admitted companies first, and if they will write the policy, great. If they decline, you're allowed to go to the non-admitted market, which is typically more expensive coverage. They're not regulated by the Department of Insurance in California. They're not backed by the California Guarantee Fund, and it's re-underwritten every single year, and they're more expensive. So if nowadays, this is the first year that I've seen many, many non-admitted companies canceling and not offering policies. So when all of those resorts are exhausted, you always have the option to go to the California FAIR Plan. And the FAIR Plan, like you said, is a pool made up of all the other admitted insurance companies, and they are your last resort policy. So they will write your home if you have trees right outside your house in the middle of a forest. They will not offer you terms just because of your location. Now, there are limitations with that policy. So if you have a larger home that needs the limitation with them is they only cover up to $1.5 million of total coverage. When you add up all of the coverages on the policy, it fits more than $1.5 million, they will max out at $1.5. So it's the first time in my career where I've seen some high-value homes in California have been totally uninsurable this year.
And that's just the property, right? So we're not talking about relocation. If someone's home's burned down, they're going to have to live somewhere else for a year or more while their home is demoed and rebuilt. So that cap, I assume, is every sort of expense.
Yeah, so it's an a la carte policy. So you pick and choose what exact coverage limit you want for each coverage category. So the dwelling coverage is the amount of coverage to rebuild the main structure, the main house. Then you can specifically pick a coverage limit for your personal property coverage, which are your contents, things that you would put in a moving van if you move from the home. Then there's loss of use, which is what you are talking about, which can help pay for food and lodging expenses if you're displaced from the home because of a covered claim, and debris removal, like you said, clearing the lot in order for a new home to be built. And, you know, when one big fire happens in a concentrated area, labor costs go through the roof, and plans and permits through the cities take a lot longer than they would if you just had an internal house fire when only one house was damaged. So it can spread out to 2-3 years for architectural plans and permits and construction to getting your certificate of occupancy to get back on your property.
And so in total, all those different a la carte can only, there's a max of $1.5 million in totality. Is it? All right.
Yeah, there is. I think the California FAIR Plan and Department of Insurance has probably been receiving quite a few phone calls about that fact and the limitation of coverage there. So I've heard rumblings that there's going to be an extension of coverage in 2020. So I can't confirm that, but we're hoping that that happens. And if they expand that, then that allows a lot more people to get more comprehensive coverage for their property.
And is there any secondary insurance to back up California FAIR Plan, or no company want to take that on?
Not specifically to back up that. You know, non-admitted companies used to be the great option when the admitted companies would decline coverage because, again, admitted is more conservative. The non-admitted companies take the riskier exposures. But even they are really tightening up on which properties that they will insure. And again, there are so many factors that each company looks at when deciding whether they're going to offer a policy to a specific person. They look at the public protection class. It's usually ranked between 1 and 10. There's a measurement there. The higher the number, the harder it is to find insurance. There's a Shia score, which is the areas that border homes and high fire line scores. There's a fire line score that's a rating between 1 and 30. Again, the higher it is, the more difficult it is, the more susceptible to having a fire damage their property. So they look at the slope, the terrain, the wind patterns in the area, proximity to a fire hydrant, to a fire station, what type of materials the home is constructed with. Are they fire resistant materials? How accessible is the property? So if your home is at the end of a cul-de-sac, there's only one way in and one way out. That's challenging for an insurance company, and they have to take a look at that before they decide to sign on the line and say, okay, I will insure your home.
We're talking with Eric Ahorn of Ahorn Insurance in San Diego. He has clients all over California, including the Hollywood Hills, Santa Monica Mountains, up in the Bay Area as well, in high fire areas. Are there particular areas that you're seeing more cancellations? I mean, particular areas prone to fires, or is this happening statewide in those areas?
You know, it is statewide. I mean, just based on the volume of inquiries that we receive and our experience, it's, you know, obviously Malibu, Hollywood Hills, Mulholland area, Pacific Palisades, Bell Canyon, Coto de Caza, Castaic, Oakland, Los Gatos, Napa, in San Diego, Rancho Santa Fe, La Jolla, Encinitas. I mean, even, you know, obviously the more rural the property, I'm not naming those because those are a little more obvious. But even in areas that you wouldn't think, you know, that just back up to a canyon, but otherwise are in, you know, more of a city-type environment, it's becoming problematic. So nobody's really safe unless you're smack dab in the middle of the grid. And, you know, even if you're there, your premiums may go up because the insurance companies have taken such huge losses. So, you know, insurance companies, it's a business. So they're looking at how much money is coming in premiums, and how much they're paying out in claims. And if those numbers are skewed, that's going to change the way that they do business.
Eric, I wanted to ask you about those renting, whose unit or house they're renting is destroyed in a wildfire. If they have separate renter's insurance, does that cover their contents, which are destroyed, the renter's contents, or is that covered by either the owner's insurance on the home that's being rented or the apartment owner's insurance? Which covers that?
All right. That's a good question. So the landlord's property insurance policy does not provide any coverage for the tenant's personal property. So I recommend all renters get a renter's insurance policy, and they're usually fairly inexpensive, and that will cover three main things. It will cover your personal property coverage, which again is all of your stuff, all of your possessions, whether it's furniture, clothes, electronics, bike, kitchen, bath supplies. It will also cover loss of use coverage. So again, if the home gets damaged in a fire and you can't live there, it will provide some compensation for living expenses, for food and lodging expenses, and it also provides personal liability coverage. So again, it's really inexpensive policies that the landlord's policy is just not going to help you. The landlord's policy is specifically for the landlord to cover the building itself.
And if you're getting renter's insurance for a property that's in a fire area, do you typically pay more?
I haven't seen that so much. It's more a question of eligibility. So they'll look at the address and they'll say, nope, I'm not interested in insuring in that area. You'll have to find renter's insurance somewhere else. I'm not necessarily seeing higher premiums on renter's insurance policies in certain areas. Again, eligibility.
Eric, for those who are struggling with this, are there ways they can, on their own, find policies that might insure them without, I mean, I know I'm speaking against your financial interests, but shy of going to an agent like yourself?
Not to my knowledge. And I wouldn't recommend it. Even if there was, I wouldn't recommend it. I'd recommend going with an expert, somebody that's involved with this and knows what it entails and what the underwriters are looking for.
But because of how specialized it is.
Yeah, very much so. And there's so many factors that come into play with each policy. And, you know, each home has its own set of characteristics that have to be looked at individually. So I don't know of any places where you can go directly as a consumer and get fire insurance. And I've had a few prospects call me and say, well, I got a quote online for this. And I am always very leery of pricing and approvals that you get on an online application for something that is very specific like this.
Okay, so very different than car insurance. Eric, thank you for being with us and sharing your expertise. We appreciate it very much.
No problem. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Eric Ainhorn, Ainhorn Insurance San Diego. He's owner and agent, and he specializes in working in a lot of high fire hazard areas where he has his clientele. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about the new operation of the Ford Theater in the Cahuenga Pass. The L.A. Phil, unanimously approved by the L.A. County Board of Supervisors to manage and program the John Anson Ford Theater. Some local performers are concerned about whether local groups are still going to have access to the 1,200-seat venue. We'll hear their concerns out. We continue after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Good afternoon. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you're scratching your head, what's he doing on? Well, for the next few weeks, you'll probably be hearing a fair amount of Air Talk in the afternoon because of NPR's live coverage of the House Intelligence Committee impeachment inquiry, the open sessions, day one of those today. The next one will be Friday, starting early morning, live coverage from NPR right here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, about a week ago, we talked with Los Angeles County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl about what was then a pending Board of Supervisors vote on having the L.A. Philharmonic take over the management and programming of the beautiful John Anson Ford Amphitheater in the Cahuenga Pass. It's a 1,200-seat venue that a couple of years ago was thoroughly renovated. It's a beautiful place. It had been managed and programmed by a nonprofit board, the Ford Board itself, but that now changes with the L.A. Phil taking over after the vote by the Board of Supervisors, 5-0 yesterday, to have the L.A. Phil run the theater. So last week, here's what Supervisor Kuehl said about the reasoning behind having the L.A. Phil run the Ford.
The Phil has the opportunity to do much wider kind of marketing in these communities than we were able to do. And they have committed to us very seriously. And that is to continue to showcase our local artists and to continue to help to develop talent as well. Because, you know, we weren't just doing summer and nighttime concerts. We were also doing community gatherings, and that's in the plan as well.
Supervisor Kuehl also explained why she thinks the Ford will be even stronger with the L.A. Phil programming it.
The reason I'm very excited, one of the reasons, is really Gustavo Dudamel, who sees this as a real opportunity to experiment. And you can see he's already done this, even in the larger venues, where there's dance troupes, where there's all kinds of different diverse music. But also, the Phil goes out into the community in much smaller numbers and does performance, does teaching, does all kinds of sort of community development. And he sees, I think, the Ford as being a wonderful venue for that, for those opportunities as well.
But there are those in the L.A. arts community who are not happy about the L.A. Phil, despite its critical acclaim as an orchestra, in taking over the far smaller venue of the Ford just across the Cahuenga Pass. At yesterday's Board of Supervisor meeting, where the decision was made to turn it over to the L.A. Phil, was KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, was there a large turnout of artists, musicians at the Board of Supervisors meeting?
Yeah, there were many dozens that came to speak in opposition to the sale, or at least to ask for a delay in the, and I said the word sale, and what I really mean is the transfer of operations, where now the county is the still the owner of the facility, but it is going to be operated by the LA Philharmonic, just like the Hollywood Bowl is. And these artists, I think the primary issue was transparency. This was a deal that was long rumored to be in the works, but only last week became sort of public. Everyone knew that this was going to happen, that this transfer was going to happen. But the other thing I think that I, as someone who personally has never been to the Ford before, learned a lot yesterday about what the Ford means to the local arts community. It's really seen by artists as an important incubator for local talent and diverse talent, not only diverse ethnically. You know, we hear from many different types of racial groups. There's a lot of programming at the Ford that's directed specifically at the Latino community, at the Black community in Los Angeles, as well as many other immigrant groups here, but also diverse in the sense of it's a dance troupe, it's music, it's theater, and it's all there. And the Ford is important for that. And there's concern about, well, what happens now that this very large organization comes in and takes over control of it?
What was the complaint about the Ford being operated by the nonprofit board? Was that they weren't attracting enough paying customers, and it was financially not viable?
Well, so essentially, yes. I mean, and it's important to say, was not necessarily explicitly stated, but reading between the lines here a little bit, attendance has not been what I think anybody wants it to be at the Ford Theater. There are many Angelenos who don't know about what the Ford Theater does, despite its sort of prominent location. And so I think there's this sense by the county that after this $80 million renovation, which you mentioned, that the county is, this is sort of my read here, is trying to get the most out of their investment on that renovation. And they figure if we can turn over operation to the Philharmonic and increase, the word marketing was sort of the primary justification given here.
Which they're extremely good at.
Is the way to try and increase the visibility and bring those crowds.
Well, and 1,200 people, 1,200 seats, that's a lot of tickets to sell for local artists. I mean, that's in it, with traffic issues and all, it's very difficult, I think, for local groups that aren't as well known to do that. The question is, though, are they going to get shut out under the LA Phil deal, or will the better marketing power of the LA Phil help those local groups be able to, get 800, 1,000, 1,200 people out to see them? Let me bring into our conversation the executive director of the nonprofit Arts for LA, Gustavo Herrera. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. Your concerns about the LA Phil programming the Ford.
Good afternoon, Larry, and good afternoon, Kyle.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes. Yeah, go right ahead. Your concerns about...
Yeah, so I think that, first off, it's important to share who Arts for LA is. We are the regional arts and culture advocacy organization for Los Angeles, and we really are tasked with representing artists, arts organizations across LA County. This is cross-discipline, cross-sectors, and also small, mid, large organizations from across the county. And so the concern that we hear are folks who see the Ford Theater as an organization who has done a few things exceptionally well. The Ford really has a 30-year legacy of offering high-profile platforms for artists of color and young emerging artists to perform at the world-class venue. The organization has been very effective in staffing diversity and also creating a very diverse board. And I think many in our community, and because we are a membership-based organization, many folks have reached out to us who are members and have said, given the county's commitment to said commitment to cultural equity and inclusion via the plan and via all the folks who were engaged in developing the cultural equity and inclusion initiative plan, how is it that cultural equity is truly being considered as this transition is happening in management? And furthermore, I think the community is very concerned that there has just been a complete lack of transparency in this process. The agenda with this item was released last Thursday. The leasing agreement was shared last Thursday, and this all went to vote yesterday.
So people want to feel like they know more what the process was, what sort of assurances are that diversity, not just in programming, but staffing of the Ford Theater is going to be there. Now, Gustavo, please hold that thought. Kyle, I want to go back to you because I was seeing that it appears staffing is going to be same team that's there at the Ford. They're not replacing the staff.
The staff, what I've been told is that staff who are currently at the Ford, it's not clear what's going to happen to them as the Phil takes over. The operating agreement doesn't start until next month, December 1st. But when it does, and they're going to take a look at staffing, anyone who is displaced isn't going to necessarily be out of the job, but that they might be moved to another job within the county. That's a commitment that the county has made because the Ford staff, many of them are county employees, if not most of them are county employees.
Oh, not of the foundation. That's interesting.
It's a very kind of knotted governance structure that involves both the county, which their funding sustains the theater, as well as the theater foundation.
Okay. So like all these sorts of lease arrangements are very complicated. No question. Let me go back to you, Gustavo Herrera. What would you want to see at this point, since the deal has been made, what do you want the LA Phil to assure the artists that you represent that what the Ford does very well, as you said, is going to continue and to grow?
Well, I think it's important that I share with you that, we commend Supervisor Kuehl's leadership in stewarding this forward. And we also want to flag that Supervisor Mark Ridley-Thomas amended the agreement yesterday to include a community engagement process. And so we think those are step forwards. Moving forward, we absolutely believe this needs community engagement, and we are committed to working with the Phil, committed to working with the Ford community and our community to engage voices around this, because our community is watching, and Arts for LA is organizing around cultural equity and arts equity. And so for us, we'd like to see the county not stop at adding an amendment to the leasing agreement. We'd like to see them take this a step forward and add an actual mechanism,
okay,
which to really inform and involve the communities in the decision.
Gustavo, let me just ask you, sort of stepping back theoretically, looking at the problems in selling tickets to some of the performers that were at the Ford, do you think that the programming needs to be sharpened so that more tickets can be sold, and that performances that are going to get critical mass of audience, that's important? Or do you think that all of these are groups with the potential to sell more tickets, it's that marketing was lacking?
We absolutely believe that the groups who have been involved in the work of the Ford have both the ability and should partner with the Phil. We know that the Phil is a pillar of our region's artistic and cultural landscape, and we think that in particularly the Artist Partnership Program and folks from that community who have been presenting at the Ford should be brought into conversation with the LA Phil as they are developing the future public program and figuring out audience development strategies. We should all be brought together to ensure that the programming is reflective of all voices.
Gustavo Herrera, thank you for being with us. Really appreciate your sharing the concerns of the artists that you represent as executive director of the nonprofit Arts for LA. Kyle, thanks very much for sharing what you saw yesterday at the Board of Supes meeting and the unanimous vote to have the LA Film manage and program the John Anson Ford Theater in the Cuenca Pass.
Thanks, Larry.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We have a significant news story that broke about an hour ago on a settlement between SoCal Edison and local agencies to reimburse for the massive Woolsey and Thomas fires. Sharon McNary, KPECC correspondent, will be with me in a minute to fill in the details. Good afternoon. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Again, in case you tuned in wondering what's Larry doing on right now, well, it's because of the hearings on Capitol Hill this morning. There are going to be a lot more of them the next one Friday, so good chance that Air Talk and Film Week will be on sometime afternoon. We don't know. We float Bob along, and where we put the show on afterwards, that's where we land. I'd ask that KPCC correspondent Sharon McNary could join us because of the breaking news over the SoCal Edison settlement over the Woolsey and Thomas fire costs to public agency, but she has two other big pieces of news I was completely unaware of. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
So let's talk about this settlement, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. So the settlement is $360 million, and it's going to be divided up among three of California's worst disasters. The 2017 Thomas Fire, also known as the Konigstein Fire, the Montecito debris flow, the mud that followed that fire that took out a lot of downtown Montecito.
And killed a number of people.
Almost like 20 in January 2018. And then the Woolsey Fire that followed just a year ago in November 2018. So it's going to be divided up a couple ways. But this settlement, it's in principle only, and it's only with 23 local cities, counties, and special districts. So none of the individuals who suffered losses, none of the businesses who claim losses are included in this.
That's still being litigated,
I
assume.
Oh, yeah, big time.
And probably will be for quite a while.
Well, and in the settlement, Edison admits no fault and says there's no liability stemming from this. They're just settling it. They're making it go away. And so those individuals and businesses who suffered losses are going to have to still, you know, affirmatively prove that they were damaged.
So this $360 million, this goes into city, county, state coffers to reimburse for the costs of fighting those fires and dealing with the debris flow.
Absolutely. I mean, there were like telephone poles moved a mile on the Montecito mud. You had, you know, water pipes getting dug up. Water systems had to be cleaned out.
101 was closed for what seemed like a week.
Oh, yeah. That was crazy. I was watching the trucks go back and forth scooping the water and mud out of there. So it was massive, massive damage. So $150 million will go to the local governments involved in the Thomas Fire and the Montecito debris flow. And then if you don't remember that fire, that was the one in it started in Santa Paula, and then it burned through Ventura County and into Santa Barbara County.
Threatened Ojai.
Oh, yeah. Threatened Ojai. It threatened, I mean, it burned a lot of the mountains above Montecito, which is what led to the mud flow. And then the remaining $210 million of that settlement will go to the local governments over the Woolsey Fire. And that's the one that started in that Santa Susana lab area. And only about a week and a half ago, the president and chairman of Edison acknowledged that their equipment, he said it in a statement to shareholders, said their equipment was involved with the start of the Woolsey Fire.
Saturday, I drove on Mulholland Highway through the area, Decker Canyon, and then the offshoot to the west before going down to PCH. And I, you know, here we are a year plus later, and the devastation, everything, almost everything just destroyed.
However, they have done a really good job in the past year of clearing those lots. You know, when a fire burns a house, it just leaves an enormous amount of toxic debris because everything that was in your house is now ash, and then it gets washed away. So a lot of that has been cleared. I think it's just hard for the different governments involved to give permits to get the houses coming back.
Yeah, yeah, and so many of these huge properties. Also, you've got a tally on the number of people whose homes lost power.
Yeah, okay, so only this year, Edison and big utilities like PG&E have had the right for a couple years now to turn your power off to reduce the risk that their equipment could start fires. But it's really only this year that that got rolling in a big, big way. We had like a million customers up north, PG&E, without power during October, some for hours, others for like weeks. Down here, I read through all of these reports that Edison had to give to the Public Utilities Commission, and I found out the number of people who actually lost power. So it's 170,000, give or take, through the, you know, very large service area that Edison has. And it was interesting. I'll have a longer story tomorrow. But basically, there was a huge learning curve for Edison as they put these shutoffs into effect. Things like they shut off power to some of the traffic signals while people were trying to evacuate from a fire. And they were being asked to weigh the public safety of people who needed to get away from a fire with their own liability and risk in turning off the lights. There were things like a hospital. Their electricity got shut off. And they said, hey, we need electricity over here. And so they managed to, like, cut the circuit that was shut off down smaller so that they could power the hospital from somewhere else. All these learning curve things. Like if you had given Edison a telephone number so they could text you when there was a shutoff,
yes,
and they had their email, they'd send you a text saying, hey, look at the email, but the email wouldn't get there for hours. So you're like, how do I know about this shutoff? And their website crashed. I mean, they had like 2.5 million views at one point.
Simultaneously?
Well, I think accumulated over. Okay. But it was more than their website could handle. And so they created a second mirror website, but it wasn't as robust as the first. It wasn't in the other languages that people speak in the Edison territory.
So much has been learned.
Yeah.
And then the PUC's launching an investigation into how PG&E and Edison handled this?
Exactly. So all of the big investor-owned utilities will have to answer to that.
All right. Any timetable from PUC on that, or just
when it happens?
Getting their work together. Sharon, thank you for the update. Appreciate it so much. And as she said, she'll have even more because she's still gathering all the facts. You'll hear it here on 89.3 KPCC, and you'll read about it on LAS.com. Thanks for joining us on this delayed edition of Air Talk, which you'll probably be hearing for the next few weeks off and on. Back with you tomorrow morning at our usual 10 o'clock time. And then Friday, we're likely to be delayed because of live impeachment coverage from NPR here on 89.3 KPCC. So again, morning edition tomorrow, usual time, the takeaway, Air Talk, and of course, take two. Be back in the 2 o'clock hour tomorrow here on 89.3. From all of us at Air Talk, have a terrific rest of your afternoon. Marketplace comes your way next.